I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today. Chicago. It has Lakeshore Drive. It has the Cubbies. It has Willis Tower. And now it has 750. That's right. The amazing 750 service is now available in Illinois. And that means that it's powerful and easy to use search tools for identifying wholesale pricing, locating trade tastings, saving lists of tasting notes, and much more, including the very excellent tool for processing credit apps, is now a click away for Chicagoland. To celebrate the launch, we here at the show are talking with buyers, distributors, retailers, and sommeliers from the great city of Chicago and releasing that series of episodes to you in the coming weeks. What is going on in the Windy City? You're going to hear it from the people who know. And if you are tuning in from Chicago itself, be sure to give 750 a try. 750.com, it's in Illinois, and it's the future. Michael Davis on the show of Heart Davis Heart. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Nice to see you.
Good to be here.
So you've had a long career as an auctioneer in the wine market. And how did that get started?
It reads like a Hollywood B-movie. It was called into action for the very first Napa Valley Wine Auction while I was working at Christie's in New York and was taking the place of one of my superiors. Had no exposure to wine outside of a friend that was a chef at the time.
How did you get to Christie's?
It was kind of an accidental process. I was looking for a job in New York. I was actually, the background was in photography. So the job I was seeking had been given to someone's nephew, and I had an hour to spare. So the recruiter said, well, I've got something here from Christie's. I had the time to spare. There was no pressure. I didn't care what I said or how I said it. So it was a very relaxed interview, probably the most relaxed I've ever had in my life because I wasn't taking it seriously. And within half an hour, I was offered a job and accepted it. And my thought was, hey, you know, I'm studying photography. Maybe this is the path I should take. And it ended up being a great adventure.
Photography sells for money now. And
right.
You were like, hey, and this is the 80s.
The light bulb went off, yeah. So my first position was in the accounting division, and I would literally call people and get their money for a jewelry purchase or a Monet painting. And that lasted, luckily, about 10 days before I got bored and they sensed it.
You had to remind people, hey, remember that big thing you got in your living room?
Yeah.
We need you to pay that.
Exactly. But it was a great experience all the way around to learn a little bit about a lot of different fields.
And you were based in New York?
Right.
And Michael Broadbent was based in London.
He was based in London. So, and I'd never met him, but we ended up at the Napa Valley Wine Auction together, and I was sort of thrown into the pit to help and spent the weekend with Michael Broadbent and Bob Mondavi and all these luminaries of the Napa Valley wine industry at that time.
And this was the first Napa Valley
wine auction? The very first one. And it was a test run all the way through.
And it was kind of the brainchild of Bob Mondavi.
Yes, and Broadbent was very involved with the planning as well. But it was a groundbreaking event, and I worked, I think it was probably an 18-hour day, and then end of the day around the table of a serious wine collector in Napa Valley, and they were pouring wines right and left, and I was a little late because I had so much to do, but they were all anxious to hear my comments on the wines, and I think some of them thought I was a wine scholar. Sure. I had no exposure to wine.
This guy's with Michael. He knows what's up.
Yeah, exactly. It's Michael's pop, so he knows what he's talking about. But when I got back to New York, I picked up a pocket guide to wine tasting, and there was a whole chapter devoted to what not to say. So I went down the list. It's like, yeah, I said that. Oops, said that too. So essentially, I made an utter fool of myself, I'm sure, but it was a great exposure.
Sounds like one of those Cosmo quizzes.
It sort of was. But that sort of set the dynamite, and it led to my moving to Chicago later on to start up the wine auctions for Christie's.
But I mean, Michael Broadbent, what was the show like?
It was amazing. I mean, he is such a magnetic, knowledgeable, magnetic, personable, charming, funny, engaging fellow, and always has a story to tell, and is big on presentation. You know, the seersucker coat and the hat and the no pipe, but only because he doesn't smoke.
Well, he's on record, I think, as being asked by Christie's to play up the British thing
early in his career. Absolutely. That was pretty obvious. And the Americans ate it up. And that was a big key to the success of their first auctions, I think, that people wanted to come and listen to him.
Because he was the first auctioneer in America because the Hublin auctions were under him.
Right, right.
In the 60s. And
those were more of a Hublin event. But the Christie's auctions were, at that time, they were held at the Drake Hotel, and a great room.
Right in Chicago.
Right here in Chicago.
Because that's where the laws allowed you to have wine auctions.
Right, right. The very first one was actually held at Marshall Fields in the Walnut Room of Marshall Fields. So we used their license and then ultimately developed our own process of doing it. The audience was composed of, it was 99.5% men. Most of them were over 50, you know, tweed jackets, cigar in the pocket, photographs of their grandkids. And they were bidding on just, as Michael would say, claret and vintage port. That was really about the only thing that the auctions contained. And there would be 240, 50 lots, and the grand total at tally at the end of the day might be 100,000.
Well, that'd be pretty high, actually.
But for that time, it was. But it was a major, major production. And all of it was, you know, surrounding Michael Broadbent. And because he would start every offering with a story about the wine and when he had it. And the last time I had this, it was with the Queen Mother. And people loved that. It was a great show.
But it was him and Jackie Quillen.
Jackie Quillen, yeah. Yep.
And they kind of reached out to you and they said, hey, why don't you come out and help us with this thing in Chicago?
Right, right. And Jackie, I worked very closely with Jackie. So, brilliant, funny. We would laugh until we cried at their times. She was great. She's still in D.C., but she was based temporarily in New York for this particular position. But she really launched it, and we worked very closely together. Jackie did not move to Chicago. She stayed in New York, and we sort of did things by remote control for a while.
Because there was an idea that there was collectors and money in America and no auctions to really
tap into. And based on the success of the Hublin sales. I mean, Christie's knew there was a market for what was going on for collectible wines.
But it sounds like they kind of sent you out to Chicago and cut you loose. Like, you know, they kept you under the umbrella brand name of Christie's, but they kind of let you
In a good way. I had a lot of independence and worked like a dog. I was sort of a 1-2 person job, you know, dog and pony show for the longest time, probably 4 auctions a year. But it really set the map for wine auctions in the country.
This was before it was legal in New York.
Right, right.
And you had also explored Los Angeles at some point.
LA opened up in the early 80s, I would say. I'm just guessing there. But Butterfield started holding auctions. And we soon after that started holding sales in Los Angeles, which were also very successful, very well attended. A lot of Hollywood glitz. It was a much more glamorous, you know, process than it was in Chicago. And a lot of the Hollywood elite were involved, and big dinners surrounding the. There was a lot of pomp and circumstance, a lot of excitement that surrounded those events.
But back in Chicago, '93 comes around. Christie's decides to roll up shop, and you cut loose onto your own name.
Right. Right. At first, it was devastating at first because it had been in my life for such a long time, but then I realized what a great opportunity it was. So we started up things again in pretty short order, and it was a great success from the get go.
That's based on basically probably the fact that you already had an auction calendar sort of set up and a lot of contacts in the region.
Right, right. And I was working out of my apartment downtown at that time, and we ran an ad in the Wine Spectator, you know, advertising the sale and, you know, giving people a process to order a catalog and get involved. And I remember the fax machine going off in my apartment in the middle of the night, and that I jumped out of bed, you know, and it was a catalog order from Tokyo. But that's how it all started. A dining room table, a fax machine in Chicago.
Has a lot of your career been sort of explaining to a mostly American audience what a wine auction is?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of misconceptions about what the industry was about and how it worked. People were afraid they would come and they would sneeze or scratch their nose and end up with a case of wine in their lap. But so there's a lot of there was quite a bit of education involved. People were reluctant to get involved with the auctions. They would sit in the back of the room and watch, you know, for a few hours, and then the next time they'd come and they'd register for a paddle. So no, there was a lot. It was a foreign. People weren't accustomed to it. Unless they'd been spent time in London or at the Hublin sales. But the whole process was new to people.
But it sounds like you made some strong contacts in Chicago in pretty short order.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Chicago is a it's always been an amazing wine town. And
why do you think that is?
Well, Chicago's a seat of power, and when there's power, there's money, and where there's money, they can afford great wines. So a lot of it just centered on that, and it was also a central location. People could fly in from New York or L.A. and easily, you know, be here for a weekend for an auction.
Did you find that the tastes in Chicago were different than New York or L.A.?
Not really. I mean, it was a matter of what was we tried to call what we thought would be popular, you know, from particular private sellers to put in. And there was no real distinction between the two at that time.
And I imagine that you've been in the game long enough that you are now, probably for some time, taking consignments from people that you originally sold to.
Yes, and that's been an amazing process. In fact, just yesterday I got a call from someone that I hadn't heard from for literally 20 years. And he's been out of the market, he's not drinking wine, and he's going through some life changes, and now he's selling. So that's been a remarkable turn of events for our industry, because 30 years ago we were selling primarily to Americans, and now, you know, the Chinese are involved and Brazilians. It's truly the global. It's a truly global market now. But and the American people who stocked up on wines in the 70s and 80s are now selling and making huge profits
for huge returns.
Right,
that.
Right,
100 times returns sometimes.
Absolutely. They get giddy. I mean, the gentleman I spoke to yesterday, he quoted a couple of wines, and I quoted prices for him, and he had been following the market for probably 10 years, and he thought I was joking. So he was truly giddy, and so I'm sure I'll hear back from him very soon.
You're Michael Davis Co., and then Sotheby's purchases that.
Right. And Paul Hart was involved with Davis. It was Davis & Company. Was a big part of Davis & Company. He and I forged on with Davis & Company, and then we both joined Sotheby's at the same time.
What was the culture like from Sotheby's to Christie?
It was very similar, actually. So we felt it was a pretty comfortable environment for us to be back in, because we were familiar with it. Of course, being in New York, there was certainly a different energy. The people that came to the pre-auction events and the dinners, where it was a different crowd. They wore their power on their sleeves a bit more.
Very New York to do that.
Exactly. But no, it was a very similar experience.
And what was Serena Sutcliffe like?
Oh, she's terrific. Very bright, great sense of humor, certainly knows her wine.
What do you think you took from some of the other auctioneers that were in the field before you in terms of your personal style as an auctioneer?
Oh, it's hard to say. I'm sure I've taken a little bit of from everyone. And it's a tiny part of my job, but it's a tremendous, exciting, fun, and at times exhausting part of what I do. But to be up there and to see the people's faces and see the activity in the room, it's definitely a high to get that energy from people who are so excited about great wines.
What do you think the keys to being a great auctioneer are?
I think you just have to be attentive to what's going on in the room. You have to sort of know the people in the room, what they might be bidding on or what they might be interested in. But of course, 90% of the activity is now over the internet, on the telephones. So you have to just remain alert and be willing to, you have to think on your feet and be nimble with your calling.
One of the companies that really did a lot of work in terms of live auction sales online was Hart Davis Hart.
Right.
So contract expires for you and Mr. Hart at Sotheby's, and you decide to join with another Hart and launch your new program. And how did that all come together?
Well, Paul and I knew that we wanted to continue in the business. It had been our lives for a long time, and we enjoyed it. We had lots of contacts, and it just felt right for us to move on and continue what we were doing in Chicago. So I had known John. I knew John Hart before I even moved to Chicago, and we had a great friendship. He had his ongoing business and certainly close ties with a lot of prominent collectors in the country. So we scheduled a lunch with John, and we very quickly agreed that we would join forces and amp up his retail business and also have auctions at the same time.
And Paul and John are not related.
No relation. Spelled the same way, but no relation. And in the beginning, with every press release, we would say, you know, paren, no relation, close paren. And then we stopped. But people were shocked. They just assumed it was father-son. but no relation whatsoever.
And he had a retail side that you integrated into the auction side.
Right, right. And John had been in the business for years and years, initially with Chicago Wine Company, and he was one of the original partners, but he split off and started his own company at one point. But it was still very involved with rare wines with collectors all around the world.
And when did it become apparent that this internet thing was really going to make a change in the auction world?
When the Chinese bidders became active, that's when we really recognized the real, you know, potential there. It was explosive. And the Chinese, they were so focused on the auctions and they were spending so much money all at the high end. I mean, for the longest time, they were focused on Lafitte. So Lafitte achieved prices that it may never achieve again. It was fueled almost exclusively by the Chinese market.
But that's like 2011, right?
Right, right. But I mean, that the Chinese have become much more sophisticated. They've been exposed to the rare wine market now and to great wine. So that has calmed. It's still a huge part of our business, but they're exploring other types of wines. They're not focused just on Lafitte, but they're building huge cellars with some diversity. So it's filtered into Burgundies, even California wines, and certainly Bordeaux.
Do you think that part of their quick evolution from, you know, it's only 2014, had to do with outside consultants from other countries? Or
everyone in the business wanted to be in China. Everyone wanted to set up shop. Everyone wanted to infiltrate the Chinese market because they realized that there was strong, not just strong interest, but, you know, deep pockets,
real money.
Deep pockets.
Yeah.
And there was a complete revolution in China in every possible way, economically and socially. So it sort of was part of the whole evolvement of China, really, that people decided, you know, hey, I want a sports car. I want to live in this beautiful apartment, and I want a wine cellar. So it was a natural evolvement, and it's really transformed the business in a big way.
But Hart Davis Hart seems to have made a conscious decision. I mean, you have a representative in Asia, but in general, you didn't make the big push into Hong Kong that some of the competitors based in New York did.
Paul Hart and I learned from experience that it's if you don't centralize your operations, you beg for issues. So we realized that the most powerful way for us to operate would be to have, and literally our offices are on top of the wines. If someone calls and has a question about a bottle, we can put them on hold and run down a few flights of stairs and pick up the phone again. That's a huge advantage for us. We didn't want to have different venues. It's expensive, it's inefficient, and it's naive to think that if someone in China wanted to bid that they
couldn't pick up the phone.
Pick up the phone or engage with us online.
Did you think that was a handicap for Christie's, having multiple offices?
No, I think it helped everyone for some people to be there because it helped publicize the process. It helped people become aware of auctions and how easy it is to participate. But we quickly found that the Chinese, they came to us. And in fact, we have an auction this weekend and we have several people coming in from Asia just for the sale.
And it seems like the Brazil market has also matured quite quickly.
Yeah, there's always been a strong, very, very strong participation from Brazil, and that's been amplified several times over in the past few years.
And why do you think that is?
Well, there's a lot of wealth in that country, and one of our longtime employees, Alan Frischman, who is one of our senior specialists, the senior specialist, married a Brazilian woman, speaks Brazilian. He spends a lot of time in the area, and that's been a huge help for us.
Because it's been not a small part of your sales.
No, not at all, not at all. I mean, we will almost always have at least a couple of Brazilians in the room and probably a dozen or so bidding online during every auction.
You're an auctioneer. Online happens. What does that mean for how you style your presentation in the room?
It has changed things. We've changed our cadence. We've changed our entire approach to how we sell, you know, from the podium to accommodate the people online. And it's given we hold the sales at True. So we have to be out of there at a certain time because they have, you know, people coming in to
dine.
So we have to really manage our time carefully. And a lot of that has to do with how we budget our time to acknowledge and give due attention to the absentee bidders that are bidding, not just online, but also on the telephones. It's a huge part of what we do. So it looks like a telethon. You know, we have a bank of phones with probably eight different people on telephones, and someone else monitoring the bids online.
And that relationship with True has been longstanding. And at one point, Scott Tyree was hired by Hart Davis Hart.
Yes.
Was it important to pair with a luxurious restaurant in the area? Was that part of the overall approach in an important way?
Well, the auction format has changed dramatically in the last 20 years. I mean, it used to be theater style seating and a traditional auction room, but blind auctions are so long. They're a day long auction, so it's a much more civilized approach for people to be around a table. They have a place for their laptop. They have a place for their shoulder bags, for their copy of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, whatever that they travel with. They have a place for that. We can serve them great wines during the course of the day, and we do. We open great bottles all day long, and True presents a really terrific buffet. So people sort of, they camp out of their tables. Their friends come over and visit. They make new friends. So it's become a much more social event, and which is terrific. People sitting around enjoying wines and sharing wines. I mean, it doesn't get much more civilized than that.
When you talked about the pacing, one of the things that strikes me about Hart Davis Hart is that it seems like the sell-through rate is high. In other words, you don't pass on a lot of lots. Everything that's offered usually gets sold. Is there a special technique that has allowed you guys to have a higher sell-through rate than other auction houses?
We take our estimates very seriously. We have a database that's probably can't be compared with anyone else's. And we have a team of people who take the whole process of establishing the value of a lot. I mean, some of them are more of a commodity than others, but when there's rarity involved, our people really, they take a look at all the results achieved by every house, and we don't peg our estimates to some exorbitantly high, isolated result. We try to, we come to a very reasonable approach. So we don't try to fluff up the expectations of the consigners. We try to be very realistic, and in fact, our success rate is much higher than anyone else in the business because of that.
So what you're saying is sometimes someone goes a little nuts, bids extraordinarily high on a lot of wine, maybe for sentimental reasons, maybe for emotional reasons, maybe just out of chance, and that can become a benchmark reference point for a future auction from another house because they say, well, someone paid $20,000 for that case.
And mind you, it takes two people to bring the price up like that. But, it takes common sense and an educated dart to come up with where we think the figure should be. We don't always get it right, but 99% of the time we do. But we don't want to give anyone an inflated picture of where their wines will be. But it's been we have a tremendous success rate.
So you'd rather sell the lot through than peg it at too high of a price and scare off potential buyers who don't want to bid.
Exactly. And people are selling for a reason. Sometimes there's an urgent need for cash. Other times they're just taking advantage of the market. But it's our obligation to sell their wines.
They don't necessarily want it.
And
we
certainly want to get the highest possible price. But you don't always get that by publishing a very aggressive estimate.
What do you get a high price from doing? I mean, what's a good way to build a higher price for an item of wine?
Well, we spend a lot of time communicating with our clients. We spend a tremendous amount of time emailing and phoning and meeting with clients around the world. These people have become our friends. I mean, I've been doing this for decades. I won't say how many, but decades. And these people are personal friends. I can say the same with Paul Hart and others, John Hart, Ben Nelson. We have tremendous relationships. And we enjoy working with them. We know what they're looking for. We let them know if something, one of their favorite wines is coming up. It's all about building, nurturing the friendships. And it's more that than thinking of it as a business. It's a relationship. It's a relationship foundation. And these people are our friends.
And you have, in recent years, posted the highest domestic sales figures for America.
Yes.
And you think that's because you've really focused on this market while maybe others have looked more to Asia? Or?
Well, I think we have a, between Paul and I and John, we have so many relationships on this continent already. So that I think that gave us a leg up to begin with. But we have people in Asia to monitor the market and develop it, nurture those relationships. So it's created a perfect storm. and one that's been very gratifying for us.
Sometimes when people consign to auction, the auction house might say, well, these are the items we'll take, and these items are really not for auction. But you also have a retail component. Does that give you a leg up in terms of taking consignments that, you know, maybe some of it goes to auction and some of it's sold at retail?
Good question. You know, there are a lot of wines that might be of a very high quality, but if there's a single bottle or two bottles, it doesn't make sense to put them on the auction market. We have found that people really focus on full case quantities or half case quantities, and we try to... It enables bidders to make a quick decision, and that's a key to keeping the auction going. Yeah, because we keep a good pace, but we also make it easy for the bidders to do the arithmetic. So if we try to offer things in full case quantities as often as we can, and the odd bottles, they make a great presentation on the retail site.
How has the retail shaken out in terms of a percentage of the business? What does it really look
like? It's mushroomed. It's a huge part of what we do. And when we receive new consignments, we, you know, blast the emails and contact people. And the phones literally ring off the walls for hours. So, you know, people sort of, they wait in the wings. They wait for us to post new wines. And we get an immediate reaction. It's a fascinating thing to watch.
Do you think that the patronage of the retail outlet is as global as the auction side of what you do?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, you know, a buyer from Brazil might call up the Chicago store and say, hey, I want this.
Right, right. And we have a consolidation point in China. So we can ship to, we make consolidated shipments to China, and clients there can pick it up or arrange, you know, local cartage. But it's a very big part of what we do. And it's roughly the same clients bidding on, you know, bidding at auction that are also buying on the internet.
So one of the things that's really unique about you is just the length of time in the business. What have you seen as an auctionable item during that length of time? You talked about Michael Broadbent and Bordeaux. Is it still mostly Bordeaux, or?
Bordeaux and Burgundy still dominate what we do. In fact, we do themed auctions that are Burgundy only or Bordeaux only at times, which are incredibly successful. But, you know, it's... there are great wines being made in other parts of the world, and those are certainly in demand as well, but it's the real focus remains French. California wines play a huge part of what we do, Italian wines, German wines, but France still dominates the picture in terms of collectibles.
And have we seen spirits at auction in Chicago?
We have. Cognacs are popular, and lately we've been selling whiskeys. And some houses aren't allowed. It requires a certain license to sell them, so we are able to get that license here in Chicago. But it adds a little color and flavor to the sales.
Do you see other emerging markets coming up that haven't already been mentioned? Are there markets that aren't Brazil or China that are going to make a play in the future?
Well, I think, you know, Mexico has a lot of promise. Panama. Russia, although it's a complicated mess to get the wines into the country, but we certainly have Russian collectors bidding in a rather clandestine way. But it's a global market, and our market follows whatever the industrial market might end up being.
Outside of it becoming more an international consumer, has it become a younger consumer?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it was in the beginning, it was a room full of grandfathers. And now there are times that we have to check people's IDs when they come in, which is great. It's a much more diversified crowd of bidders. Many more women are involved, which is gratifying. And it's ever changing. Several languages are spoken in the sale room on any given Saturday. And we can usually find someone on the staff that can communicate directly. But it's certainly a much younger crowd than it once was.
Have the price escalations surprised you over the course of your career?
I'm no longer surprised by any trend in the market. But 5 years ago, when the prices spiked the way they did for Lafite and Burgundy, it was, our heads were spinning. Anybody in the business would have said that. Unbelievable prices were being obtained for the higher in Burgundies and Bordeaux. No one, I think, ever could have imagined the prices of that sort. But now that the new economy and the new global market is a bit more predictable, we can see the trends beginning, and we can see where things are going. And we've done in mind as we appraise any collection.
How much is entertaining part of the auction business?
It's a big part of it. Again, it's built on relationships. So there's a number of us that spent a lot of time on the road in different markets around the globe, just taking clients to dinner. Sometimes it's a group, sometimes it's one-on-one, but we keep involved and engaged in their lives. And that's really a strength for us. I mean, I mentioned before that somebody that had sent me a list that I dealt with 20 years ago completely fell off the map. He contacted me by phone yesterday, and he's ready to sell. So it's about friendships and developing a sense of trust. And the gentleman just said, I'm not calling anybody else. You know, I dealt with you 20 years ago, and no one else is going to get this collection. And that's music to my ears, that we've developed that level of trust and that kind of those sort of friendships among collectors.
So it's not so much a needle in a haystack to try to find consignments. It's more about developing relationships and letting the consignments come to you.
Yeah. No, and you develop the relationships, you maintain the relationships, and these people have become personal friends. It's not just a business relationship. I'm deeply involved in people's lives, and I can say that about a lot of my colleagues. We spend times in their home. We know their children. We know their dogs and cats, and we're very involved with their lives, and that's a wonderful feeling.
Does that work as fraud protection as well? I mean, there's a part where someone might inspect the bottle, but then there's the part where, I don't really know that guy, and he seems kind of fishy to me. And
we take every measure necessary to ensure the authenticity of the wines, and luckily, we haven't had too many issues with that. We're very careful from the get-go.
Seems like relatively unscathed. That's why I asked.
Yeah, I'm hesitant to say any more than that. But no, we take great care. We know the people that are selling. If we don't know, we ask a lot of questions. We dig deep into their sellers, and we're very, very careful about what we take in. Do we always get it right? No. At times, something might slip through the cracks, but we always make things right.
Have producers had more of an awareness about those kind of issues in terms of working with you?
Well, the producers, the vast majority of our consignments come from private collectors, but producers they're very engaged in the process. And I know there are some very highly publicized occurrences of producers showing up in other sale rooms and being very vocal about questionable bottles.
But I mean, is it possible for someone in an auction house to call up someone and say, hey, what would your label have looked like back then? We're just trying to figure it out. Or is that not possible?
No, most of them are very cooperative. If we have questions, we'll send a photograph of the bottle, of the label, of the capsule. So most are cooperative in terms of, ascertaining the authenticity. We try to stay away from the older bottles. We focus more on younger vintages. We just don't want to. We don't want to create any issues. We don't want to take any chances. We owe that to ourselves. We owe that to our clients. So if we're absolutely certain of the authenticity, of course we'll sell a really old bottle. But that's we don't do that very often at all.
So if it looks too good to be true, it may be.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you have brought to you major collections like the Steve Verlin sale. What was that like, and why do you think that didn't end up in a New York auctioneer's hands based on where he lived?
Again, it was relationships. One of my colleagues was in New York and had dinner with, and we all knew Steve from Sotheby's. He was a big collector there and was always active in the sale room. So we all knew him. And when he passed away, one of our colleagues had dinner with his wife, developed a strong friendship. And she was very determined to come to us with a collection.
What was it like marketing that sale? Because it was, a pretty big deal.
It was a very big deal. It helped put us on the map, and it brought a lot of people to the fold that we'd never dealt with before, people from all over the world.
And what other sales have been big for you?
Well, since that sale, we've had new bidders come in with every auction, frankly. So that was a watershed moment for us. Clearly a watershed moment. We've had other, tremendous sales. We had an auction earlier this year of a gentleman in Houston, a great seller, full of phenomenal burgundies. That, too, was a high watermark for us. So we're single-owner sales such as that always attract a little more attention. They're a little more personal. There's a little more romance to the seller. So it always attracts a little more attention.
We often hear about the hammer prices, and I feel like a lot of times auctions are judged by how high the hammer prices end up being and how many lots are sold. But I often wonder, what the number of consigners and number of buyers really is. I mean, how many consigners and how many buyers does it really take to support a major auction house over 10 years? What's the actual number of buyers on the market?
Boy.
Is it in hundreds? Is it in thousands?
It's in the...
I mean, of regular buyers.
Of regular buyers, it's in the hundreds. In terms of consigners, the auction we have coming up this weekend has 60 consigners. Some are single case, some are multiple cases, hundreds of cases. But it's hard to pinpoint, you know, a number like that. But certainly there are thousands of active collectors, but the ones that are regularly active, that regularly would be in the hundreds.
So even though it's a multi-million-dollar market, it's really 100 people, or I mean hundreds of people, not, you know, millions of people.
It would be safe to say thousands of people, but I mean not everyone participates with every auction. It's a rotating, you know, we deal with people who have very fast lives, and sometimes they can focus on an auction, other times they can't. But on a regular basis, hundreds of collectors participate.
And who goes to pick up the wine?
We very seldom get a list that's 100% accurate. There are always, you know, miscalculations, or it's like, oops, I forgot I drank that case. But we typically, if it's a large collection, we'll always send a team of people to the seller to oversee the packing process. If it's a collector we've not dealt with before, we certainly want to be there to inspect the cellar, and we get on our hands and knees looking for any bottles that are leaking or any sign of issues with the cellar. And oftentimes we'll reject wines. We'll reject entire cellars, even if they're worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. If we're not comfortable with the manner in which they've been stored, and we determine that by tasting the bottles, if we're not satisfied with how the wines were sourced, we don't knock on that door. So we don't want to invite any issues or any chance of selling wines that are out of condition.
Do you think it's important to be a wine lover as well as a wine seller if you're going to be a good wine seller?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we all drink great wines along the way, not every night, but I think having an appreciation of the wine helps us get excited about them, helps us express that excitement. If we have something in-house that we've all tasted, and we have a huge collection of German wines in-house right now, and they're lovely. They're wonderful to drink in the summer. So by tasting them, by having a tasting for the employees, it makes it much easier for us to sell them, to express just how exquisite the wines might be.
When you have employees that come to you, do you have certain characteristics that you say, that guy's probably good for auctions, or that young lady would be great for retail? I mean, what's the characteristics of one side of the house to the other?
You know, it's a very integrated team. I don't think there's anyone that works exclusively with auctions or retail. It's very much a team effort. So everyone's involved with every level of the business. And I think that's the only way to do it. We all need to know, you know, the strengths and weaknesses of every system, and that way we would improve the process along the way.
How many auctioneers does it take to have an all-day auction? I mean, how long can you go before you're like, I don't think I can, you know, I need to sit down, have a glass of water.
There was a time in my life that I would do almost an entire auction all day long, with a brief break now and then, the right amount of coffee and adrenaline. But we have now about five or six auctioneers. We rotate on a regular basis. It keeps people fresh. Just keep the people in the room fresh too. If you hear the same voice drone on and on for 6 or 8 hours, it's going to put people to sleep. So it keeps everyone alert. It keeps us fresh, and we keep things accurate that way.
What advice do you give the younger auctioneers?
Well, it's all about paying attention. You know, have eye contact. Express yourself. Take a personal approach. Call a client by name. You know, let them know that we know they're there. But it's a matter of paying attention, keeping a rhythm. We don't have time. We're there for a compressed part of, you know, schedule, because dinner's going to be served at True, and we know we have to clear out of the house at a certain time. So it's all about engaging with the people, developing eye contact, having a rhythm, keeping some levity in the process, and express some excitement. It's a great process, and the auctioneers always have the best seat in the house, because they can see everyone's face and see every paddle in the air. So it's a invigorating position for us to take. And we always encourage people to express that, you know, let people know that you're excited to be up there.
once you got going, was there a sense that this was going to be your career for 30 years?
When I first set my toes in the business, it was, I had no idea that it would be, you know, such a long career. And in fact, looking back, had anyone told me, what I, you know, 40 years ago, what I'd be doing for a living, I would have just laughed. But it's been, the process itself, aside from being around great people and drinking great wines and learning about them, it's the process that's so exciting. Developing the relationships, being in cellars that, and knowing that the collectors have been working, building this collection for, you know, years and years and years. And it's getting involved with the people, the collectors that are selling. You have this, such a deep involvement with them. Sometimes it's for a month. Sometimes it's for a week. Sometimes you finish the process and you hope you never see that person again. But more so than not, you develop these great relationships that endure. I've been dealing with the same people, some of them for 30 years. And you get very involved with their lives, with their children, with their dogs, their cats. And it's the process that keeps me going.
It's the relationships that have kept you in the game.
The relationships. And you know, the things you learn from different people and visiting their homes and seeing their cellars, seeing how they experience wines and what a place the wine has in their own lives. I have great memories. You know, I deal with some of the people's sons and daughters who might still have a few bottles that their father had left. And that it's always great to hear from them. But the relationships have been enduring and they've really enriched my life. It's constantly invigorating.
Michael Davis, he's been excited to be up at the podium for several years now, and he continues to be at Hart Davis Hart in Chicago. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Davis of Hart Davis Hart.
Thanks very much.
Chicago. It has Lakeshore Drive. It has the Cubbies. It has Willis Tower. And now it has 750. That's right. The amazing 750 service is now available in Illinois. And that means that its powerful and easy-to-use search tools for identifying wholesale pricing, locating trade tastings, saving lists of tasting notes, and much more, including the very excellent tool for processing credit apps, is now a click away for Chicagoland. To celebrate the launch, we here at the show are talking with buyers, distributors, retailers, and sommeliers from the great city of Chicago and releasing that series of episodes to you in the coming weeks. What is going on in the Windy City? You're going to hear it from the people who know. And if you are tuning in from Chicago itself, be sure to give 750 a try. 750.com, it's in Illinois, and it's the future. Thanks for listening. Our road trip to Chicago will continue in the next episode coming up. If you're digging what we're up to, you can always find us on our website, alldrinktothatpod.com, or follow along on Twitter for updates, @drinktothatpod. We're also on Facebook, and I take some snazzy pictures on Instagram. If you want to really support the show, please consider a donation of funds to this ridiculously shoestring operation that lives on a wing and a prayer, or just purchase a t-shirt to wear around. You can find the details about how to do so on our website. And if funds aren't at the ready, just leave a nice comment on iTunes. Every little bit helps. Cheers.